Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Brad Ferlin, Vermont Viewpoint, in beautiful Waterbury, Vermont. We have a great show this morning. We're starting with Lila Bennett, who is Journey to Recovery Community Center Director and an author of a book you're going to want to hear about. Anthony O'Shaughnessy joins us from New Hampshire today for the Granite Recovery Center. Tim Johnson Arsenault, Vernon Town Clerk, Verdon Moderator, longtime radio news personality, will be here at 10 o'clock. And then at 10:30, Senator Thomas Chittenden. He's a senator and a South Burlington Council member. So we hope you stay with us this morning and join us for the show. My morning started at about 5:30, and I got up. I have two Norwegian elk hounds, got them fed. My cat protesting that hadn't been fed in days, it seemed, the way she was carrying on. Went out into the barn, and we have 10 sheep. I threw them some hay. I went out, and all the water buckets were frozen this morning, and the hose running from the house was frozen, and there were oak leaves in the buckets, and so they were having cold oak tea this morning, my sheep, and I'm hoping they're happy about that change in their life. So my first guest this morning, I'm so excited. She came down from the Northeast Kingdom, and she's joining me, Lila Bennett. Welcome, Lila, to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, and it's quite a haul for you in the morning to get here, too.
Yeah, there was quite a lot of traffic that, I mean, I sort of anticipated it, but it was a haul.
Yeah, I noticed the same thing coming down from St. Albans. There was an enormous amount of traffic on the interstate. I think we got used to this COVID world where nobody was out, and all of a sudden, there they are.
Yeah, and I think maybe the road construction, trying to get ready for winter, the last few projects, there was quite a bit of road construction.
Yeah, that's what
But it was still beautiful, and I loved the drive coming down.
Yeah, well, good. Well, welcome. I'm so glad you're here. All my guests today have what I call many hats, and Lila is in that category. You are the director of a recovery center up in Newport. You're an author. You're a recovery coach, and you're a mom, and you got life on your plate, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yes, all of those things. They're all kind of related too. I mean, they all kind of have to do with healing and nurturing.
Yeah. So let's start with a little bit with the recovery center, yes, and then we'll move in. I sort of teased our listeners this morning. Your book is provocative and wonderful, by the way. I think it's an amazing book. So we'll start a little bit with the recovery center. You're up in Newport. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on up there?
Absolutely. So our recovery center is called Journey to Recovery Community Center, and it's in Newport. It's right across from the hospital. I've been working there since COVID, since 2020 is when I stepped into the role, and we've gone through tremendous change. We moved the location. It used to be kind of in the middle of risky neighborhoods where there was lots of there was just lots of active use happening, and it was very triggering for people. So we moved the center, and now basically what it is it's a peer support recovery center. So it's not clinical. There's no clinical therapy happening there yet. But what we do is all the coaches who work there are trained in how to support people who are trying to change their life. And everyone who is part of the center has shared or lived experience. So they've either struggled with some kind of an addiction or they have a family member who has. And so you're coming at it from that standpoint of like really understanding the struggles that someone is facing and how hard it is to change your life and what goes into what you need to do to be able to change your life. It's definitely a big commitment.
Yeah. I'm very interested in the fact that in beautiful, small town Vermont, you're talking about a risky neighborhood, and we don't think of it that way, but it's really everywhere, isn't it?
It is everywhere, and it's very real, and it's in all demographics as well. Like, the Northeast Kingdom is picturesque, it's beautiful, we have really caring people, tight communities, but we also do have a lot of substance use, and all different kinds of substance use. We have a tremendous amount of alcoholism as well. And then with the opioid epidemic, it's very insidious. It affects everyone. I think especially I can speak mostly to my area, but almost everyone can say that they know someone who has been affected by some kind of an addiction. And people are really struggling, and the opioid problem is creating a lot of destruction. We have drug trafficking that's happening, that's coming up from bigger cities and then landing in our little small towns and kind of attacking the most vulnerable people, especially in COVID when people were home and they were kind of directionless and struggling. Maybe lost their jobs, home with kids, a lot of that kind of stuff. So, it's everywhere, and it's also possible to get some help. And that's what we're doing, is we're there to say, look, like, it's okay. If you ended up in a place that's not helping you, if you are in trouble, even if you just think that you might be in a little bit of trouble using a substance, you can come talk to us.
Yeah, and I love what you said, your peer-to-peer on this.
Yes.
So somebody walks in. I mean, you know, clinical is great, but when you have walked the walk and somebody comes in, they're not going to tell you a lie that you're going to believe. You know it. and you're going to be able to bring them along. And I love what you're saying about hope, because
yes,
even at the bottom, the most destitute place of life, there's still a way up.
There always is a way up, and that's what we talk about at our center, is what is recovery? So recovery is not just, I used to drink too much and now I don't, or I used to use heroin and now I don't. It's recovery is how do you learn how to have the skills and take the steps to create peace in your life and fulfillment in your mind and body and heart, and also how you forgive yourself for mistakes you've made, and then how do you step forward into a life that you feel really good about, where you value yourself. Recovery is about learning how to value yourself, and I think one thing that's hard in our culture, especially with social media, is just the extrinsic pressure to get validation from the world. And so we say, like, hey, we're going to take that away. Let's look at how you can validate yourself.
Yeah, and a lot of people feel they're alone, right? That they're the only ones in that predicament. But if they come into these centers, they meet people who have gone through the same things, right?
Right, and it humanizes struggle. So, like, you come into a center, and people are so scared to do that, take that first step. Like, they don't want to be judged. They don't want to be told what to do. They don't want to feel more shame than they already feel. Shame is huge. And so you walk into a peer-led recovery center, and we say, hey, you know what? We get it. It's okay. And it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It doesn't mean that your life isn't a huge mess right now. But that's okay. And there's ways to fix it. And we've been there. Our lives, we've all hit our tremendous bottoms. And these are the things that we did. And we might say, hey, you know what? Maybe getting some clinical mental health counseling in addition to this would benefit you. And this is how you can do that. And we try to kind of triage to all the different resources that someone might need. Are you housing insecure? Are you in a domestic violence situation? How can we get you all the different kinds of support? And generally speaking, once people make that first step to come in, they have just so much relief. And the last thing I just want to say, I know for me, for a long, long, long time, I thought that I was like, I'm an intellectual person. I can think my way through my problems. Like I can fix this. And I just resisted therapy because I thought it was like a sign of weakness. And I think our culture kind of tells us that. And then I went to my very first therapy session, which was mental health, and said, why didn't I do this 10 years ago?
Yeah, I remember going to some therapy sessions where I thought nothing possibly could come good of it. And then you have this epiphany in there, and it's like, oh, my God, thank you.
Yes.
I'm talking this morning with Lila Bennett. She's an author. She works the Journey to Recovery Community Center up in Newport. And she's also has a coaching business, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. So I started the coaching business after I wrote my book. So I've been running the Recovery Center in Newport, and we coach people there, and that's directly related to substance use. Anything that has to do with that, which is often very wide-ranging. Relationships, childhood trauma, all that stuff plays into that. But the work through coaching at the Recovery Center is it's generally crisis-based. It's kind of like, how do we take steps forward to immediately save your life? And then on the side, I was playing around writing my book. I had gotten really heartbroken, and I didn't want to be heartbroken again. And I was looking at my own healing and my own process for that. And so I wrote the book, and then people started asking me for support. Like, they would read the book and say, okay, but now I need to process this. I need to dig into the deeper aspects of what you're talking about, because my book is it's a workbook. It's not a big, long, you know, it's simple. It's written for people who are really busy, as I am, but still want to make this progress in their life and understand themselves better. And so I started doing it for fun. And then I realized that I really loved this, that the coaching that I was doing on the side, that I am doing on the side, is very forward thinking. It might be for people who are stuck in one aspect of their life. Like, maybe they're making a career change, or maybe they have everything kind of figured out, except they keep having the same dysfunctional kind of relationship, or their parenting they're struggling with how to really support their children the way they need to, or they keep losing their temper, or whatever it is. And so I started taking, I only have time for about 4 people every month, 4 new people every month, but I've been doing it, and it's really exciting to be able to help people create the life they really want, but they couldn't quite get to the step to be able to accomplish whatever their dreams and goals are. And I think it does go back to that peer coaching model of, I had to do it myself. I had to manifest and visualize and work hard to look at where I was, why I was there, and then where I wanted to go, and understand that on a very deep level. And it's ongoing. We're always healing. We're always growing. We're always understanding more. But being able to help people really understand where they were, why, where they are, and where they're going is exciting and fun.
It's a great thing, and being able to, you know, go through what you have gone through and then be able to share and help people on a journey is just a remarkable gift. You have a website, motherroadvermont.com, is that right?
It's motherroadvt.com.
Yes.
And I started that at the same time that I wrote my book. I actually was thinking about doing that before I finished my book. It's just a blog. And my stress relief besides exercise is writing. And it's a way for me to just process what I'm feeling, write about different experiences. And I realized I was writing for fun and sending some of my little stories to my friends, and they were like, these are so good. And so I decided to put them into a website and create a place of resource for other people, because when I was going through my divorce, I felt very alone. And I just felt like I was the only one making this huge mess of my life. And sometimes it's nice to have a little humor about that stuff. And so some of the blogs are just about the reality of how messy life can be. And so I write those with some practical information, but also with just life.
Yeah. We so find that we're alone, right? So many times. And then, when we start sharing a story, people go, oh, wow, wait, that you're telling my story. And,
yes.
And then all of a sudden we don't feel so alone and we can see some light. So it's motherroadvt.com if you want to learn more about what Lila's doing. And, if you need some coaching, she's going to be a great coach for you. Now we only have about five more minutes, but I want to get into your book. So,
great.
I don't want station manager Steve Cormier kicking us out of the studio if we swear here. So, the title of the book is F, and then maybe a little star, and then that. F that. So, let's get all the little children out of the room, and we'll talk a little bit more about this book. But it's a remarkable book, and what I saw is you were both clinical and you were amazingly brave and personal. And that is not an easy thing to do. You put it out there, and I love that, because then people go, okay, I get it. She gets it.
Yes. I wanted to be real, because that's what I needed when I was trying to figure out my life. I needed people to be real with me. And then once I started to put together some of the aspects of how I was making the decisions I was making and what was the emotional ways that I was relating to others and to myself, and how to look at the ways that was healthy and unhealthy, and then how to stop repeating the patterns that were not healthy. Like, I like to say that I'm a recovering codependent. And when I first was getting divorced, I learned about codependency. I hadn't really learned about it before. But then that was it. It was like, okay, well, that's codependency. Yeah, I don't want to be that anymore. But there's so much more to it. Like, why was I codependent? How did I become that way? What was that doing for me that somewhere in my ego and my mind was telling me that that was going to protect me and keep me alive? And what was I actually looking for? How do you truly understand what your emotional needs are? And so that's what this book is about. It's like, okay, I got fed up with myself. I was repeating patterns that were actually not serving me. And so how was I going to stop doing it? And so I did that, and then I wrote it down. It was like, other people, I am sure, are in the same place of being in, like, this book came because my relationship after my husband, I was married for 17 years, then did a bunch of healing. I thought I was, like, better. Ta-da! And then I got into another relationship with someone who was just really emotionally unavailable. And so I was constantly in this place of feeling needy and not feeling good enough, or feeling too much, or I was too sensitive, et cetera, et cetera. I think maybe many listeners can relate to this. Or maybe someone listening would feel like they were being smothered by their partner, which was exactly how my partner felt. And I had to study attachment theory and all kinds of stuff. And I know I'm trying to be cognizant of the time because I could talk forever. But this book is really, it's called F That, A Step-by-Step Guide to Claim Your Worth and Heal Your Broken Heart. And that's exactly what it is. It's my story, but it's also like the practical stuff that leads you into these dynamics that aren't healthy. And then you get to look at why. And then you get to look at how to stop doing that. And what do you need for real?
And it's possible, right? You can change your life.
You can change your life. I have changed my life. I am a living, breathing example. Brad, I just realized as we were speaking that you didn't know that I was a full-time farmer for 10 years. Probably there's people out there listening who know me as a farmer only. And we had the first Vermont-inspected slaughterhouse for chickens in Vermont. And I was a chicken farmer and a pig farmer, and we had a small herd of beef for many, many years, and I was doing that. And then, you know, life needed to change, and we're not going to have enough time for that. But I had to go from, like, being in a place of exhaustion and struggle and codependency and overwhelm and self-loathing and really looking at how I was going to change that and what kind of mom I wanted to be, kind of partner I wanted to be and have. And and I've done that. Now I'm an executive director of a recovery center, helping people every day. I coach people on the site. I wrote this book. It's happening, and it's because of the commitment to heal.
Yeah. We're talking with Lila Bennett. She's a author, coach. Her website, motherroadvt.com. I want to thank you so much for bravely sharing your story. Her book is F That, Try Not to Throw Us Off the Air. And thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Good morning again. This is Brad Ferlin on Vermont Viewpoint here in beautiful downtown Waterbury. My first guest was Lila Bennett, and she's staying in for the next half hour because it turns out that she works very closely with my second guest, Anthony O'Shaughnessy, and he is with Granite Recovery Centers. Welcome, Anthony.
Oh, welcome. Thank you for having me. Yeah, Lila and I have worked really closely together for the past almost 2 years now, and we've become good friends and helped a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, Anthony.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good.
Hey, Lila.
Hey.
Good.
So thanks for being on. Both Lila and Anthony participated in a recovery summit that was held on about a month ago, and Granite Recovery Centers was sponsored, and Anthony, you were integral in helping out on that, and we thank you for that. Want to start? Just can you give us a little insight into Granite Recovery Centers? You're over in New Hampshire.
Yeah, sure. So Granite Recovery Centers, we've got four locations in New Hampshire and one in Portland, Maine. Roughly 400 beds total, and I think what kind of distinguishes Granite from many other treatment centers throughout New England is that we're basically in network with about 40 or so commercial insurance carriers. So we can serve just about anybody who has health insurance in New England, either through an employer or from the marketplace. Additionally, we are in network with all three Medicaid MCOs in New Hampshire. So anybody in the state of New Hampshire can engage in treatment with us for up to roughly 90 days. And then if you have commercial insurance and you're in New England, you can also come to treatment with us, as we're in network with everyone.
Yeah. And so being in network and having all that resource, what that boils down to is if I'm having this moment of clarity in my life, if I'm using or alcohol, drugs, whatever, and I suddenly want to get help, that means you're there, you're ready, and people can get help and a bed. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think another thing that really distinguishes Granite from probably what we're seeing in Vermont, at least what I'm hearing, and then what we see frequently at other smaller treatment centers throughout New England, Granite has just a lot of volume and pretty sophisticated operationally. So if somebody is in having a moment of clarity and in need of treatment, almost without exception, unless there are really severe medical, biomedical complications or something psychiatrically that they're too acute, we can, in most cases, get somebody in the day that they call in. If they call in the morning, it is very common that they're in that afternoon or early evening. Certainly by the next day, the average is probably about 48 hours, because in most cases people call, they want to get packed, take a day to get their stuff together before they admit. But if you want to admit on the same day, that's an option, and we can make it happen almost without exception.
Which is really important, because they may have that moment of clarity, but if they can't get a bed, then they often go back to what they're doing, right? And then you may, you know, we lose lives in those periods of time. People don't get the help they need.
This is also true. And in New Hampshire, again, regardless of the insurance you have, if you're somebody who's homeless, living in a shelter with New Hampshire Medicaid, or you don't have shelter at all, you're actually on the street, you decide that you want to go to Granite Recovery Centers that day, you can be admitted that day. We can induct buprenorphine if that's something you choose to do, be on MAT services. But at the very least, you know, and that's to help keep you comfortable and not in a withdrawal state, so you're comfortable if, in fact, you're using fentanyl or any other opioid on the street. But you'll have a roof and meals, three meals a day, shelter for up to 90 days. And the nice thing about coming to treatment at Granite or New Hampshire in general is that there are so many affordable housing options. While there is a housing crisis across New England and certainly in New Hampshire, people who are in a treatment setting, because there is so much sober living in New Hampshire, they're really ideally situated to have good housing when they leave, somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 a week to maybe $200 a week. Oftentimes the first month is covered through grants. So they're covered for, they get 90 days in treatment. They come out of treatment. They have the first month covered with the understanding that they're getting a job and able to cover the $150 to $200 a week moving forward. And sometimes people stay in sober housing, you know, for up to 2 years. So there's just a lot of infrastructure to support people in their journey to, you know, maintain long-term abstinence.
Yeah, and one of the things you're raising, and we'll get a little bit into detox and then recovery, but what we know is that if people are, you know, maybe they get help for a couple weeks in some situations and they get discharged because insurances don't cover, or maybe they get a month if they're lucky. But then they often return to their neighborhood, to their, you know, where they were using, where they were addicted. And we see failure with that. But you're telling us a different story. They can come in if somebody is really, you know, needs to detox. They can come in, get that taken care of with you, and then have a longer-term plan and a much better chance of success. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, that's exactly what you're hearing. So we have 36 standalone detox beds. It's a facility specifically for detox. We have an additional 15 at another facility, so a total of roughly 50 detox beds. And then what New Hampshire and Granite has done a little differently is we have, you know, what's a step down from detox, which is the most acute level of care, is residential level of care. Now, in Vermont, my understanding is they're traditionally able to stay. Insurance will cover that for somewhere around 14 days, maybe up to 17 days. And the same is true in New Hampshire. They're covering between 14 and 20 days, in some cases, maybe up to 28 days. At that point in Vermont, we're seeing people go back to their home communities, really short durations while in treatment. In New Hampshire and at Granite Recovery, they can step down to what's called a partial hospitalization or PHP, and then a step down from that is an intensive outpatient or an IOP. Both of those are roughly 30 days long. They're traditionally delivered in an outpatient setting, so someone would have to live at home and travel into these to program daily. Instead, we are providing the recovery housing and the meals. So there's just so much data out there showing that longer durations in a controlled environment, in a safe setting, where others are administering your medication and where you don't have direct access to alcohol or other substances, your chances of maintaining long-term abstinence improve dramatically with those longer durations in a controlled setting. And we've been able to do that by offering the PHP and IOP levels of care, which are normally delivered in an outpatient setting. We're providing the housing to allow for those longer stays.
And there's a lot of recovery centers in New Hampshire. I believe in Vermont, we have Valley Vista and Serenity House are sort of the
two inpatient rehabs.
Inpatient rehabs,
yes.
Yeah. We
do also have Act One, which is in it's in the Burlington area, and that's specifically for it's a shorter 5-day detox program.
Okay, great. So we're talking with Anthony O'Shaughnessy with Granite Recovery Centers and Lila Bennett, who is recovery coach in up in Newport. And Anthony, you and Lila work together. How is it that a recovery center in rural Vermont and New Hampshire? What's the communication there?
Yeah, good question. So when I started at Granite Recovery Centers, we, again, serve all of New England. We have all these in-network contracts with commercial insurance carriers. We had never done any outreach, and really very little outreach had been done at all in Vermont from any of these other New England treatment centers. And so we saw an opportunity to help serve the Vermont population. And so I made it my mission really to get out and get in touch with as many people as possible. And right away, the Turning Point Center seemed like the hospitals and Turning Point Centers seemed like logical places to start. And so I reached out to just about every Turning Point Center and told them who we are and how I think Granite can be helpful to some of the residents in your state. And I think Lila, like me, just genuinely really enjoys helping people. She's a helper. This is kind of what she's been put on earth to do, connecting people to services and finding them access to drug and alcohol treatment is really her mission in life. And so we connected on that level. And so anytime somebody has choice in treatment, right, they have maybe a commercial insurance through an employer or they're 26 years or younger and they're on mom and dad's insurance or whatever the case may be. In some cases, we've been able to scholarship some folks. If somebody has choice in treatment and can leave the state, then she's typically reaching out to me. We'll often send a driver to go pick them up, and then they're able to stay with us for, like we said, up to 90 days. The communication is great. The case management has been great. And so that was the genesis of our relationship, and it's just grown from there.
Now, Anthony, we'll start with you, but Lila can jump in. There's really value to change of venue, so to speak. If you're in Newport, Vermont, say, and need recovery, coming over to New Hampshire can give you sort of a fresh outlook and new start without sort of the distraction of everything that was taking you down?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of truth in that. I know I'm a person in long-term recovery, and when I first went to treatment, and it did take me more than one trip to treatment, unfortunately, but that's true for a lot of us. I did go quite far away. I went to Arizona. Now, this was in 2012, before there were very many treatment options in New England, and my family and I didn't know much about what we were doing, and that was helpful at the time. It really helped me kind of just get my mind right in a different environment away from everything that was going on here, the people, places, and things we talk about. Now, fortunately, there are so many good options right here in New England, and so we don't have to travel halfway across the country or all the way across the country to get really good, high-quality clinical treatment. And for Vermonters hopping right over the border to New Hampshire, it's a great option. But still, we see some reluctance, and people are somewhat provincial and like to stay close to home, which I totally understand. So there has been some pushback in some cases, but I think we've had a lot of luck getting people to consider just taking a trip to New Hampshire, changing up the environment. And in some cases, what we've seen, Brad, is that they'll choose to stay in New Hampshire because there are these affordable housing options, because they make friends here in the recovery community, and there's a really robust, thriving recovery community, especially in the southern part of the state in Manchester, New Hampshire. There's just a lot going on in terms of meetings, housing, recovery rallies out in the community. I think it's never a bad thing to change up your environment.
Yeah, and Lila, you mentioned some success stories. Can you tell us that?
Absolutely. So I think for one thing, it is true that trepidation of wanting, of being scared to change everything. But that is sort of, once you accept that that's going to help you, there's so much success. And as I was telling you off the air, Brad, we had a great example of a woman who was really struggling, and she was struggling with alcohol, and she would try really hard, and then she would end up drinking, and she ended up in the emergency department 13 times in a row. And it was just like, and it was progressive. It was like getting worse and worse and worse, and she just couldn't get the support, and she couldn't change people, places, and things. And so we Anthony helped me get her into his program, and that was over a year ago. And she's living in Manchester, and she is thriving. She is sober. She is doing so well. Her mom still lives in Newport. We get updates from her all the time. It's truly a success story, and we've had like three or four of those sort of long-term successes. We also have had people who have been scared to go. They've gone to New Hampshire. They've done it, and then they've spent the 90 days, and it's given them enough coping skills, resources, and connection under their belt to be able to return home. Also, what Anthony has at Granite Recovery is once you go through the program, they have meetings that are accessible by Zoom. And so it's a community that you never have to leave. And so we have people who have been out of Granite Recovery for a year now, and they still every week sign on to the meetings and are a part of that support. And they also access support through our recovery center and through coaching. And, they've built their network, and that is what it takes, is building your network.
Yeah, it's Anthony and Lila. This is amazing. And Anthony, can you give us a little bit of contact information for Granite Recovery Centers? People are looking for help. How do they reach you?
Sure. I think the best way, our admissions office is open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., 365 days a year. The number is 855-733-0808. Of course, anybody is always welcome to call me. I'm even willing to put my personal phone number out here over the airwaves. I take calls all day, every day. Oftentimes, I can't even help them get into our treatment center, but I find them another resource if it's if that's what they're looking for. So happy to help any way I can. My number is 603-860-3839. And then if they just want to explore more about Granite Recovery Centers, they can go to graniterecoverycenters.com. And if they want to ask questions of our admissions office, they can ask admissions@graniterecoverycenters.com.
So we've got Lila and Anthony here. Lila, a coach and help at motherroadvermont.com. Anthony, Granite Recovery Centers. You broke the ice, both of you broke the ice a little bit, that we there's politics involved in this, and politics are based on borders, right? New Hampshire, Vermont, but it really addiction doesn't have borders. And the it seems to me what we're calling out here today, Anthony and Lila, is that we've got to just forget about the politics. We've got to make the insurances work. We've got to cross the borders, and we got to get people help where they need it.
Yes.
How they can best improve their lives.
Yes. Can I hop in and just say one thing about that? Absolutely. And I think that's why Anthony and I work so well together, is that we are here to help people. We want to get people what they need when they need it. Also, if anyone is curious and wants to reach out to Journey to Recovery Community Center, they can reach out to www.jtr-cc.org. They can also call me at 802-624-3844. And I also want to say that due to that, like, struggle that we have here in the state of access to care, because we do only have two inpatient rehabilitation centers, and those are generally 14 to 17 days, and it's really difficult to get people in, like Anthony was saying, that they can get people in same day or within 48 hours, and that is so important. And so what we're doing at Journey to Recovery is we are opening today. We're having a bed. We only have one bed, but say you get that window and you know you want help, but it's going to be a week to be able to get into treatment here, or we're trying to figure out your insurance to be able to get you to Granite, you can come and stay at Journey to Recovery Community Center overnight. It's 24/7. We are opening this bed today, and this is because we need to help people. We need to meet people where they're at, and this is one thing that we can do.
Okay, I want to thank both my guests again. Anthony O'Shaughnessy with Granite Recovery Centers. I'm going to have you back. It went too quickly. Lila mm-hmm. Bennett, same thing. We've got so much to talk about. And there's hope, right? There's hope there, and we can make a difference.
Thank you
so
much.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. This is Brad Ferlin on Vermont Viewpoint here in downtown Waterbury, Vermont. My roots go way back. My grandfather was a psychiatrist at Waterbury from the late 20s until the 60s. Lived right on the hospital ground here, and both my grandparents are buried in a local cemetery here. So Waterbury is deep in my heart from my early childhood. If you want to join our conversation today, it's 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK. My next guest is man of many hats as well, Tim Johnson Arsenault. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Brad. Good morning, and welcome from the Banana Belt.
Yeah. So when we say hats, we say town clerk, we say town moderator, we say justice of the peace, we say 42 years as a broadcaster in Brattleboro, WDSA down there, totally different market from up here. You've done it all, Tim. Amazing.
Well, I haven't done it all yet, Brad. I haven't cut the album I've always wanted to cut. I haven't written the book I want to write. There are many careers left in me.
Well, and if the viewers, probably listeners, would know down there that you're also quite a national anthem singer as well. Is that right?
Yes, in fact, it was 1 year ago yesterday. I was blessed to be able to sing the anthem at Senior Day for the Castleton football team. My grandson played his last varsity game that day, and now he's an assistant coach for the team.
Wow, amazing. So I want to read something real quickly to you, Tim, and then we'll go from there.
Okay,
and it'll sound familiar, I think. Macomb was an old town, but it was a tired old town when I first knew it. In rainy weather, the streets turned to red slop. Grass grew on the sidewalks. The courthouse sagged in the square. Well, that's Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird. You're in Vernon, Vermont, which is probably under a lot of sort of assessments could be called a sleepy little town, but I doubt that it is. And who knows better than the clerk?
Well, I grew up here. I was born at Brattleboro Memorial Hospital. And the Vernon I grew up in was a sleepy little town of 800 people. Then 1970, voila, the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant came in and went online. And all of a sudden, now in 2022, we have a 2,300-person population. The population gradually grew, dipped a little bit following the 2015 closure of VY, and then came back.
And things of, I mean, Vermont Yankee was a huge employer in the area. It was generous in contribution. But you've come back, you're saying, and things are going well again.
Yeah, we are. I mean, I think a key part of that change was having the Vermont Council on Rural Development come with its community visit in March of 2016, right after I came on board as town clerk. The select board a few months earlier had gotten this together, and it caused us to take a serious look at ourselves, and really the glass is half full rather than half empty. Several grants have taken place. Several new projects have taken place. Among them, the Visitor Center for Vermont Yankee back then is now owned by a new nonprofit called the Friends of Vernon Center. It actually was the original home of Vermont's first lieutenant governor, Jonathan Hunt, and so we've always called it the Governor Hunt House. In addition, we have taken a serious look at our recreation assets, and currently there is a planning grant given by the state to inventory all of our recreation assets. We still are quite aggressive in making sure that we are what we always have been, which is a great place to raise kids, a very good school system, very good recreational facility. And, you know, taxes have gone up some, but we are still below the level of our neighbors. And it's funny, I once heard a town manager say that after a good meal, you need to pay the check. And I guess that's what we're doing.
Yeah. So I'm curious. I haven't been down to Vernon in a number of years. I had visited Vermont Yankee from time to time. It was quite massive, of course, cooling towers and everything, all of that. What's the site look like now?
Well, as I can see from across the street, and I am across the street at Town Hall, the cooling towers have come down. The smokestack has come down. They are working on taking care of all of the non-nuclear parts of the plant site. The low-level radioactive waste has been shipped off-site. The high-level waste, of course, as you know, is all encased in dry cask storage. And as long as that's there, there'll be people guarding it, of course. But the long-term goal is to see it redeveloped, and its future is up in the air, according to the current owner, North Star.
Okay, so North Star is still working on the greenfielding process, so that's ongoing now, I'm hearing.
Yes, it is.
Okay, all right. So, town clerk, tell us a little bit about your – I mean, you're surrounded by Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont. You're in the corner, the southeast corner of Vermont, in a little town. What's the clerk's job? What's the interesting part of your world in the building?
Well, it's funny. The bottom line here is other duties as required. We start off with filing birth certificates, making certified copies of birth certificates, then making sure that the students have a chance to be able to apply for a scholarship fund. Yes, we do have a scholarship fund for town residents for their first 4 years of post-secondary education. It's not a lot, but it's a little, and it's an incentive. It went away for a couple of years, but now it's back thanks to our annual town meeting. In addition, we will issue you a marriage license, and as a justice of the peace, I've probably done about 24 of them during the COVID era, many of them for out-of-state residents since we were right on the border. In addition, dog licenses, looking out here, filing land records. In addition to all of that, I handle a lot of the social media and the website for the town. We also can do what's called the Green Mountain Passport, where veterans and people over 65 can pay a small fee and get a free pass to all Vermont state parks and historic sites. We also do death certificates, and we sell cemetery plots. And I may have left something out.
Yeah, well, that's quite a list. And I don't know if I aptly think this correctly or not, but I think of clerks like hairdressers in a way, that you have all the town people coming through. You get to chat with them day in and day out. You really become the keeper of the pulse of the community. Does it feel that way to you?
Well, I would tell you that we need to stay confidential, but you do end up hearing a lot.
Yeah. clerks are highly regarded. I think that Vermont clerks are hardworking and really they're integral to the whole works of each town, and we certainly thank you for your service on that. Town moderator, what you've done that for quite a long time, right?
And 25 years now.
25 years.
I kind of tongue-in-cheek say that I've told the entire town to shut up and sit down. It's funny, they're still talking to me.
Well, good. And hopefully most of them did what you told when they needed to. So what does the town moderator do?
The town moderator handles the annual town meeting via Robert's Rules of Order, making sure that people have the opportunity to be able to speak and be recognized, and that the meeting is run without fear or favor of speaking, or that making sure that personal attacks do not take place. We try to make sure that people stay on point. And I ran for this job originally because, frankly, it was a position where I saw people in the audience trying to deal with some discussion, and quite frankly, I saw an old-timer being heckled, and I wanted to put a stop to that. So I ran next year, and that's been taken care of.
Well, and you've been doing it for a long time, and I know that you're highly regarded in the community for that. And also, you know, we're seeing the town meetings sort of disappear in Vermont, but really, Vernon has kept that tradition, and you get people come in and they can raise their hand and vote, and they can express their opinion. Is that what happens?
Oh, definitely. And even during the COVID era, we held two straight town meetings outside during the month of May, so people would have a chance to be able to have those sorts of conversations.
We're talking this morning now with Tim Johnson Arsenault. Tim is town clerk, town moderator, justice of the peace, town of Vernon. And for 42 years at least, you also are a radio guy. And not only a radio guy, but you were inducted into the Vermont Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame, which is quite an honor.
Yes, thank you. I have been at this since my senior year of high school in October of 1973. So probably makes it all told about 49 years. And I've still been doing radio part-time since I became town clerk because, A, it's something I still really enjoy. And B, my other boss, Kelly Corbio, WTSA in Brattleboro, was a force of nature and, frankly, is someone you don't say no to.
Yeah, and I was talking earlier with station manager Steve Cormier here, known as Corm, and you and Corm worked together, and he was praising your work ethic, that you were up at O Dark 30 at the station preparing news, getting ready, and you're just a true pro.
Well, I would tell you that I'm still probably up at O Dark 30 because old habits die hard. One of the first things I do in the morning is switch on the 4:30 a.m. news on WCAX and kind of figure out whether Dom Amato was wearing a tie.
So tell me, you know, doing radio that long, what were some of the highlights of being, really, you become a personality in the community and you get to, you report the good, you report the bad, you do it all, really. What are some of the things that really stick in your mind?
Well, I would tell you that I got into this wanting to be a rock and roll DJ, and as a shy kid with a stutter from a small town, the odds were against me. I just decided to keep working and kept my head down and found out that the news guy actually made a little bit more money. I have met some great people over the years. I think probably my highlights might be holding a cassette recorder with a handheld mic at a Windsor County Republican committee meeting. And at that point, former Governor Joe Johnson, who was a Springfield machine tool executive who was governor between 1955 and 1999, looked at me and said, "Are you the House Speaker?" I smiled and said, "Not yet, Governor." He told me to keep at it. But I've enjoyed a good relationship with political leaders of all parties. And in fact, I'm probably the only person of my bent to have a copy of Robert's Rules of Order autographed by former Governor James Douglas. It's been in some interesting times, including just being in shock the moment on the air that the Shuttle Challenger exploded back in 1986. Then fast forward to 2001, I was heading to Boston for a Boston Celtics media day with my then boss, John Kilduff, when we heard the Twin Towers going down. I made probably the fastest trip from Gardner, Mass. Back to Brattleboro with one hand on the cell phone and dialing. I don't think John has ever ridden with me again. But that was a day when, you know, for the first time in a long time, I think I could probably compare it to listening to AM radio back in the late 60s, 1968, where you just had a feel of uncertainty for the nation. And I felt that while I was on the air trying to make sense of it all. And for some reason, all that has kind of stiffened me over the years. I remember being on the air probably about 15 hours during Tropical Storm Irene in 2011, trying to figure that out. I mean, my hometown of Vernon was basically untouched, but part of Brattleboro's downtown was underwater. There was high water rolling through the intersections of 9 and 100 in Wilmington. There were a lot of people that were in bad shape, and then I started using social media to get some of the word across, and I was hearing some amazing stories. Like, for instance, a woman asked where her state check was, and I didn't know until after that a good part of where you are, Brad, in Waterbury was underwater, and the Agency of Human Services had to get out of town hurriedly in the middle of Sunday night. So, you know, there were a lot of things that trying to figure out how to get the word out to people. And nowadays, Facebook and Twitter are standard for getting the word across, as well as, of course, radio and online streams. And you got to go where the listeners are.
Yeah, and you reminded me of a local governor, Governor Thomas Salmon, who was a resident in your county and a good friend to all of us. I remember Governor Salmon talking. He ran in 1972. He campaigned for about 2 months. He won the office. He had been a legislator before that, but he tended to have the opinion that if you work together, you could achieve more. And I always appreciated that about him. And you had many an interview with Governor Salmon as well.
True. There were a number of lawmakers, politicians who, set aside the party label to work together. Two that I would say, as well as Governor Salmon, were a former House Speaker Tim O'Connor and longtime State Senator Robert Gannon. And I wonder just what either of them would say about some of the political turmoil going on in our state and in our nation right now.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of opinions about that. And you know, I always try to be positive and hope for the best. And I hope that as we come into the legislative season in January, that people put aside their political differences and just, we're coming out of COVID. We've had hard times. We got to look for positive solutions to a lot of the challenges out there.
There are a lot of challenges out there, and certainly we're in a season where COVID isn't done. It may be at lower levels, but we still need to be proactive on that. Plus, now that people are getting out more, they are seeing flu season kicking up as well. So especially if you're over a certain age, it makes sense to get yourself vaccinated and protect yourself.
Yeah, so we've seen, you talk about sort of getting information out to the public. We've seen newspapers around Vermont, you know, some of the dailies have lost some of their fervor. People are more tuned to the social media world and sort of getting instant information. But radio, and you're a veteran of it, radio is still a big part of this instant communication. If you're in your car, if you're, you know, at home, you can, you tune in. People are tuning in right now on their computers. It's still a big part of our world, Tim.
It really is. And I try to make sure that I give it all the credit it deserves. And quite frankly, radio has fed my family for many a year.
Yeah, so we're talking with Tim Johnson Arsenault. We have about 3 minutes left. Tim, you have been a person of service to your community, which, you know, is usually in the 10% of the population do a few things. You do a tremendous amount here. You get elected. You're trusted. You've been this radio personality for years, and I just want to thank you. And in fact, the listeners should know that Tim is, you know, at work right now. He's taking a little time. I'm hoping there aren't four people up at the front lobby waiting to get dog licenses or have you married them.
Only about half dozen from the senior citizen group. They're holding a Thanksgiving dinner downstairs at noon.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I hope that goes well. I hope they slide you some turkey and some gravy as well.
Well, I brought a donation, and I'll be saying grace for the meal as well.
Awesome. You do it all, truly.
And I even sing happy birthday to them for their annual birthday dinners.
All right. So we have 2 minutes left, Tim. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you want that you know, is important that our listeners hear from the town clerk or the radio guy?
I would say that, firstly, this was the most contentious election this past week I've ever seen. And I think we all of us need to do a better job in getting the word out about what the laws are. because I think that some of the clerks took the brunt of it from people who really were unaware of the ballot being mailed out for the general election and thought it was up to us. It was not. It was Vermont state law. You know, we all need to do a better job of getting that word out. And in fact, speaking of getting the word out, I found that social media is a great tool in getting the word out at a local level. On days when I'm in the office, I not only do a little missive, but I also do a video on my personal Facebook page and a non-official town Facebook group to let people know what's going on, meetings, et cetera. Yes, we're open. This is going on. Here we are.
All right. Well, Tim Johnson Arsenault, thank you so much for your time this morning. You're a great guest, and we love hearing everything you're doing, and I appreciate you being on the show.
Well, thank you very, very much, Brad. It's been a pleasure.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Good morning. This is Brad Ferlin, WDEV in Waterbury, Vermont. Got up early this morning, went out to the barn, threw some second cut hay out to the our sheep. We have 10 sheep, two lambs, only about 6 months old. And my daughter now, this time of year, she and I are the farmers. She likes to go out into the barn and when it's cold like this, and our Finn sheep snuggle up, and she just relaxes in the hay, and it's just kind of a friendly scene of serenity out there when that happens. My next guest is Thomas Chittenden, who is a South Burlington City Council member and recently reelected as to the Vermont Senate. Welcome, Thomas Chittenden.
Brad, it's great to be with you on the phone. I'm sorry I couldn't be in person. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great. And not only are you a city council member and a senator, you're also a lecturer at UVM, the Grossman School of Business. And we're talking about our guests this morning, all have lots of hats. Those are only a few of them, right?
That is. I also, similar to you, though I don't have any beautiful lambs, I just have some rabbits and chickens. So I have a small farm, but I would love to maybe look into adopting one of your lambs. I could get some free lawn mowing out of them. It's been something I've been thinking about for some time. But
well, we have a couple of cute little ewes that might add to the South Burlington landscape. And I know that you've had others. I think I've been at your house in the past, and there's been turkeys and all sorts of things walking around. So
yeah, we like to expose the kids to a lot, as many animals as we can. I'm trying to get a pig, but my wife is not supportive of adopting or having a pet pig, but I'm still working on her.
Yeah, well, it's always an adventure. So you've been on South Burlington City Council now how long?
I'm serving my eighth year, and as I announced last March, I'm not going to run for re-election, so my term ends this coming March. But I've served three terms for a total of 8 years.
Wow. Okay. So that has been, I assume, painstaking in some ways, but also rewarding, being able to give back to the community. Are there some highlights on that that you would talk about?
I think we could do more as a state to recognize the hard work and toils of our locally elected leaders. It is a lot of work for almost absolutely no pay, in most cases no pay, and people only reach out to you when they're angry. You don't often hear from them when they're happy. So I just want to thank everybody that serves on a school board, a select board, on a library board. It's important, critical work that keeps our communities together. But it is a grind, if I could use that word. It is a lot of mental labors, a lot of chores, a lot of time. But there are the positive highlights that you speak to. I always loved going to the awards banquets and the receptions for the recognizing the police and firefighters each year. Those are always great events. And also, you know, the ribbon cuttings. Like in South Burlington, we just opened a dog park. Some would argue it should have been opened sooner and it could have different characteristics, but it's a great space that's open to the entire community and region. We don't check any cards at the door, so you can take your dog to the Wheeler Nature Preserve Dog Park if you so desire.
Yeah, and it's like you said, there's a lot of night meetings. There's a lot of commitment to that, and you have to run for office. This is an elected position, being a council member. And when you run for office, you really expose not only yourself and your personal life, your family, your children, everything gets sort of scrutinized. And it's not an easy thing. But you persevered three times successfully and have done well with it.
It is a different realm. I never pursued political life. I sort of fell into this role about 8 years ago when my friend John Wilking asked me if I ever thought about running for office. But it's never something that I had in top of my mind. My career is at the University of Vermont. It's still where my career is. I dabble in local and state politics now, and I hope I'm doing well. And what I do like about these elected roles, Brad, is that every 2 years and sometimes 3 years with some seats, the voters get to tell you whether or not they want you to keep doing it. So that's useful to validate your efforts or not, and focus them elsewhere if the voters tell you to try doing something else.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that a little bit with your Senate, the recent election. But I also want to get back to, you know, you are doing, you're stepping up to the plate. As I was talking with Tim Johnson Arsenault earlier, he has a lot of hats like you do. And there must be, I mean, I'm guessing you have three kids. I'm thinking that they must be very proud of what you do and being a role model for them and for the community is very important.
I hope so. I like to model service, but this is how I was raised too. I was raised to give back and contribute to my communities. My uncle served on the South Burlington City Council. He was also in the legislature. My father ran for council. He was also involved on the Board of Civil Authority and the Restorative Justice Board, the first iterations of it that have now really solidified in the county. I grew up in Vermont, and it's a commitment and culture and community of service. So it's just something that we have to do if we really want a government of the people, by the people, for the people. That starts at the local level.
I will mention that you were the Student Affairs Faculty Senate president, I think, at one time, and you were also awarded in 2017 UVM's President Distinguished Lecturer Award. You've gotten some accolades along the way. UVM, of course, it's our university, sort of our learning institution in Vermont, well known. How is it nowadays to be a lecturer? Are the kids there? Are they active? Are the students engaged? Are we seeing a promising future?
Yes, absolutely. The students are back, and it's great to be back in person after the almost full 2 years of being remote. And the student body this year is definitely impacted by the COVID experience. I'm seeing it with my own three kids who are in high school, middle school, and elementary school. But there is a not necessarily a learning loss, but a change in how students were learning over the last 2 years that is making us rethink how we deliver different content. But yes, I am a lecturer over here at the Grossman School of Business. It's a great, I don't know if you follow, within the departments at UVM, the Grossman School of Business is about 10% of the student population, and that's where my role is primarily focused. And I'm just really proud of what Grossman has done over the last 10 or 15 years. If you come on campus, you'll see a brand new building, the fact that we're named, we have more professorships coming on board. We're number one green MBA, according to the Princeton Review, for the past 3 or 4 years. So it's just remarkable how the unit on campus that I've been so focused with has really taken it up a level and really put Burlington, Vermont on the global map when it comes to business schools in a lot of great ways.
And what a great place to be in Vermont. Your students not only enjoy the academics, but they can ski, they can do all the recreational hike, all the things that we love about Vermont.
Indeed. Maybe too much skiing. So I'd love to study a little bit more, but I think that's going to be a perennial complaint of any UVM faculty member.
And we won't even get into other things that students do. So you're a family man. I follow you on Facebook, and I'm often jealous of your creamy adventures and donut adventures and park adventures and stuff. I mean, you've managed to juggle a lot of time to do everything you need to do as a dad.
So I always say I used to have a life and now I have kids. I do everything so that I could provide for them. I will say that I don't know if I'm as good of a dad as I could be, but I do try to compensate for it in the summertime. So my lovely wife, she teaches over in Colchester, and so she has summers off. And at the University of Vermont, I'm a 9-month faculty, so I also have summers off. So as much as I hope I'm doing right by these kids, if I miss a band recital or if I miss a game during the semester when I'm also doing a city councilor and a state senator, I do like to compensate for it in the summers and commit as much possible time as I possibly can to make sure that I'm a part of their lives growing up here in Vermont.
Well, all the pictures I see of them, they're smiling faces, say it all. And, you become connoisseurs of the maple creamy, which is dear to my heart. And, those are good adventures. You're also in a community where, do a plug for Al's French Fries. It's sort of a epic institution in your community.
Gotta love Al's. So I have a list of best creamy spots in the great state of Vermont. But after you account for, you know, different variabilities, if that's the most important thing to you, if it's rather or not the purest of the maple or the ambiance, I will say by far best in show for creamies in the state. I'm sorry to all my friends, different creamy spots, but definitely it has to go to Al's because it's just been around for so long and it's an experience unto itself.
Well, that's a pretty good plug, and I think I may want to get a creamy today, even though it was pretty chilly this morning. I was telling our listeners that the buckets out for my sheep were all frozen, and the water hose that I put the water out for was frozen, and I realized I've got to get the heated buckets out, and the world's changing. We're talking this morning now with with Senator Thomas Chittenden, and also South Burlington City Council member Thomas Chittenden, and a lot of other hats. We finished up an election last Tuesday, and you persevered to become senator again, second term. That must feel pretty good.
It certainly does, and I really appreciate everybody who got out to vote. It was a great election with a great turnout, and the district that I'm now lucky enough to represent for 2 years had the highest turnout in the great state of Vermont across all the Senate districts, so I'm even more proud of the Senate district that I represent.
Well, and I know you to be a humble person, Thomas, but I went to the Secretary of State's website, and there were 5 people in your district in a race, and you were the top vote getter, I think, for the second time in a row. And I think that speaks a lot for how people respect the job that you do. And I know you as a fair and even-handed legislator and appreciate that service. But congratulations on being top vote getter in the largest district in the largest county in the state of Vermont. It's pretty good.
Certainly does feel good, and I just, again, appreciate people getting out there to vote. I've been on the ballot 8 times in my life so far over the last, I want to say, 8 or 9 years, and every single one I ran like I thought I was going to lose. And the most important thing, I just try to get out there and show up where voters are. So to your listeners out there, if you invite me to an event, I'm going to come if my schedule is free. And I see that as one of the most important things I can do as an elected leader, elected representative, is to just be there and to show up when things are happening in my community that people want me to be a part of.
Yeah, and I know that you research issues carefully. You're well-versed on things, and you listen to people, which is a great attribute. were coming in, you were, when you were first elected, it really was in COVID time, and it was in time of Zoom calls and time of lack of connection. You didn't even get the glory of going to the State House, the Golden Dome, and networking with your colleagues and with the public. And now I believe you'll be going back live, and you'll get to enjoy some of that. Tell us how that feels, and also, you know, what are the challenges you see coming up for the Senate in January that are going to be most pressing for you?
Great question. So when I was elected back in 2020 for my first term in the state Senate, you're right, it was the peak pandemic. That was this summer, right after the world stopped turning. And so the entire campaign was a different animal altogether, with no parades, no public events. And then the service for the first, I would say, 75% of my first term was all virtual. It was all online. Whenever I would talk to people, as I was trying to do so from my living room to get a first on the issues, almost the first thing they would say is, this is so much better in person. And I would add, it's not just better, it's actually more effective. So the last 25% of the term, half of the last session went into in-person, and that was my first in-person experience. And I agree. I found I got so much work done in between the committee room and the cafeteria. That's where you have the important conversations, where you get to understand the ideas, you find out who you need to talk to, and you just keep your finger on the pulse of a lot of things. I didn't have any rich conversations from my living room to my kitchen when I was virtual. So I do think that the legislating needs to be done in person for a lot of different reasons. The virtual delivery and accessibility is still important for people to participate and engage in democracy. But I will say, for the legislators themselves, you can't beat in person from my limited experience with one term so far. As for this coming session, I ran to serve. Maybe I should have a more pointed agenda. I do have some ideas. I think the three topic areas that we need, and I do have specific bills that I'll be introducing on these areas. Happy to go into details. But really, it's child care, housing, and the climate. I was wearing shorts last week in the second week of November. It was 70 degrees for almost 10 days straight in the month of November. I think we need to recognize that there are things that we can do and that we can join with other states in this country to consider ways to address the climate emergency that are reasonable, that make sense, and that will gradually shift with a glide path towards different factors in our economy. As for housing, there are things we could do at the local zoning level. I've got some ideas on that. And still, Act 250 deserves more attention. And then child care, I've got two specific things. There's a lot that we can do, but two that I haven't heard enough discussed that I want to put on the table, having to do with when we mandate or permit school districts to set the kindergarten entrance age. The current policy in Vermont is kind of out of step with the rest of the nation, and it does create additional pressures and burdens on our child care system, while also creating inequities across our zip codes. So there's something there, and I also think there's a way to look at how our commercial real estate properties could get tax prebates when they rent to child care facilities. So as to make child care offers more financially valuable, or incentivize putting child care centers where people are, where people work, where people need to be, and aligning our current tax code with educational facilities for K-12 with the just as equally important 0-5 services that we offer. That was a long-winded answer, Brad. Anything I could elaborate on? Or?
Well, it's a great answer, and my earlier guest, Lila Bennett, wrote a book called F That, which needs no more explanation. But you brought up Act 250, and Act 250 is almost like a swear word in Vermont in some capacity. It was enacted to protect our environment, and I appreciate that. But it has been viewed as onerous over the years. And if you're going to tackle something like that, how it sort of cross threads my question to you is, you know, there's a lot of camaraderie in legislative process we see. How do you sort of break the ice on things that just haven't changed over time that you see are important to help Vermonters?
That's a great question. I think it was Rahm Emanuel who said, never waste a good crisis, or something to that extent. We have a housing crisis in this state. I'm not saying we need to throw Act 250 out. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Act 250 has done great things for the state of Vermont, protecting our rural landscape and allowing for some zoning protections for communities that didn't have zoning. What I want to see us do is continually to modernize, to evolutionize, to revolutionize, not revolutionize, that's the wrong word, but to evolve Act 250 to address the needs of today. And what I see today is that we need to make it easier to build a house in the great state of Vermont, and we need to make it harder for individuals to derail housing projects in areas that communities have said we want housing to be there. Lawsuits, dragging environmental court, zoning ambiguities, that costs money, and that money isn't taken out of the pockets of developers. It's put into the price of our houses. And so if we want to address the housing crisis, we need to make it easier, less rigorous, less onerous, less problematic, less litigious to build housing in the areas where near our population centers, in our downtowns, and elsewhere. To do that, you're absolutely right, Brad. I'm seeing my service in the legislature as being very relational. It's not just what you know. It's your relationships, your how you communicate, how you connect with other people, how you work on conversations over cups of coffee rather than over the headlines. And that takes time. And so I think it's just a matter of continuing to put your shoulder behind the block and try to move it forward.
Well, we appreciate that. And you're youthful, you've got some time, you're patient, and I think that's going to be great. I want to briefly mention that there was a Thomas Chittenden once upon a time who was born in Connecticut, but he came to Vermont. He served as a delegate that helped frame the Vermont Constitution. He was elected president of the Vermont Council of Safety. And he was also the first governor of Vermont and then served a second term. And I think there's a similarity in name and maybe a relative. Is that right?
There is. So he is my seven greats, great, 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 great uncle. His brother Bethuel and sister Elizabeth actually moved up to Vermont and settled Vermont. Bethuel was down in Tynemouth for some time until he landed in Shelburne for most of it. He's actually buried in Shelburne right across the South Burlington border. But Bethuel and Tin Thomas settled the great state, did a lot to carve out and define the edges of the great state of Vermont. And I'm just, as much as I love my heritage and my great-great-great-great-grandfather Bethuel, I'm glad my parents chose to call me Thomas rather than Bethuel. It's fallen out of social favor. So
you're lucky you're not in high school now, because you'd be Bethuel from here on in. We're running out of time, Thomas. I really appreciate everything, all your service, all your hats. We wish you the best of luck in the Senate in January. We hope that you can be the leader that we hope from a younger generation moving forward. And I appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Brad. It's always good to talk to you.
All right. I want to thank our listeners. We can't do radio without you, and look forward to being with you next time. This is Brad Ferland, WDEV, Vermont Viewpoint.